Okay, so we are in ready to begin Daniel chapter 4. I'll read the whole chapter. How about that? That's right. That's right. Okay. Daniel writes this. King Nebuchadnezzar, to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. It has seemed good to me to show the signs and wonders that the Most High God has done for me. How great are his signs, how mighty his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion endures from generation to generation. I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at ease in my house and prospering in my palace. I saw a dream that made me afraid. As I lay in bed, the fancies and the visions of my head alarmed me. So I made a decree that all the wise men of Babylon should be brought before me, that they might make known to me the interpretation of the dream. Then the magicians, the enchanters, the Chaldeans, and the astrologers came in, and I told them the dream. But they could not make known to me its interpretation. At last, Daniel came in before me. He who is named Belteshazzar after the name of my God, and in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. And I told him the dream, saying, O Belteshazzar, chief of the magicians, because I know that the spirit of the holy gods is in you, and that no mystery is too difficult to you, tell me the visions of my dream that I saw and their interpretation. The visions of my head as I lay in bed were these. I saw and behold a tree in the midst of the earth, and its height was great. The tree grew and became strong, and its top reached to heaven, and it was visible to the end of the whole earth. Its leaves were beautiful and its fruit abundant. And in it was food for all. The beasts of the field found shade under it, and the beasts and the birds of the heavens lived in its branches, and all flesh was fed from it. I saw in the visions of my head as I lay in bed, and behold, a watcher, a holy one, came down from heaven. He proclaimed aloud and said thus, chop down the tree and lop off its branches, strip off its leaves and scatter its fruit. Let the beasts flee from under it and the birds from its branches, but leave the stump of its roots in the earth bound with a band of iron and bronze amid the tender grass of the field. Let him be wet with the dew of heaven. Let his portion be with the beasts in the grass of the earth. Let his mind be changed from a man's, and let a beast's mind be given to him, and let 7 periods of time pass over him. The sentence is by the decree of the watchers, the decision by the word of the holy ones, to the end that the living may know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will and sets over it the lowliest of men. This dream I, King Nebuchadnezzar, saw, and you, O Belteshazzar, tell me the interpretation, because all the wise men of my kingdom are not able to make known to me the interpretation. But you are able, for the spirit of the holy gods is in you. Then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was dismayed for a while, and his thoughts alarmed him. The king answered and said, Belteshazzar, let not the dream or the interpretation alarm you. Belteshazzar answered and said, My Lord, may the dream be for those who hate you and its interpretation for your enemies. The tree you saw, which grew and became strong so that its top reached to heaven and it was visible to the end of the whole earth, whose leaves were beautiful and its fruit abundant, and in which was food for all, under which beasts of the field found shade, and in whose branches the birds of the heavens lived. It is you, O king, who have grown and become strong. Your greatness has grown and reaches to heaven, and your dominion to the ends of the earth. And because the king saw a watcher, a holy one, coming down from heaven and saying, Chop down the tree and destroy it, but leave the stump of its roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze in the tender grass of the field, and let him be wet with the dew of heaven. Let his portion be with the beasts of the field till seven periods of time pass over him. This is the interpretation, O king. It is a decree of the Most High, which has come upon my lord the king, that you shall be driven from among men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. You shall be made to eat grass like an ox, and you shall be wet with the dew of heaven, and seven periods of time shall pass over you till you know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will. And as it was commanded to leave the stump of the roots of the tree, your kingdom shall be confirmed for you from the time that you know that heaven rules. Therefore, O king, let my counsel be acceptable to you. Break off your sins by practicing righteousness, and your iniquities by showing mercy to the oppressed, that there may be perhaps a lengthening of your prosperity. All this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of 12 months, he was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon. And the king answered and said, Is not this great Babylon, which I have built with my mighty power as a royal residence and for the glory of my majesty? While the words were still in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven, O King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, the kingdom has departed from you, and you shall be driven from among men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and you shall be made to eat grass like an ox, and seven periods of time shall pass over you, until you know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will. Immediately, the word was fulfilled against Nebuchadnezzar. He was driven from among men and ate grass like an ox, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven till his hair grew as long as eagle's feathers, and his nails were like bird's claws. At the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my reason returned to me. And I blessed the Most High, and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation. And all the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing. And he does according to his will among the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. and none can stay his hand or say to him, what have you done? At the same time, my reason returned to me, and for the glory of my kingdom, my majesty and splendor returned to me. My counselors and my lords sought me out, and I was established in my kingdom. And still more greatness was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, for all his works are right, and his ways are just, and those who walk in pride, he is able to humble. Great chapter. Say that again. Yes, exactly. That, as a matter of fact, hello, Nick. Well, I thought you were waving hi to me when you you were waving me off. Okay. Yes, as a matter of fact, the very last statement is turns out to be the theme of the whole chapter. And the next chapter, too, as a matter of fact. But anyway, so just by kind of way of background here on the chapter, the question comes up, when did this happen? We saw in these first three chapters that it was, those first three chapters covered probably the first 4 or 5 years of the captivity. Maybe the first 5 years of the captivity. So Daniel and his three friends at the beginning of chapter 1 were probably around 15. They were probably around, you know, somewhere around 20 at the end of chapter 3. Then at the beginning of chapter 5, chapter 5 is the end of the Babylonian Empire, isn't it? That's what we're going to see. Correct? You remember your Daniel history? Daniel reads the writing on the wall for Belshazzar. And so Daniel in chapter 5 was in his early to mid-80s. In Daniel chapter 7, notice, he says, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream. Chapter 7 starts the visions part, half of the book. But that vision in chapter 7 obviously was given to him between chapters 4 and chapter 5, just a few years before chapter 5. Okay? Chapter 5 is about when Belshazzar gets humbled. That is, he gets completely taken out. Chapter 7, that vision occurred in Belshazzar's first year. So, 5, 6, chapter 5 and 7 and 6, they happen when Daniel's in his early to mid-80s. Chapter 3 ends with those four being about around 20. So the question arises, when did chapter 4 happen? These great Gentile empires, they did keep historical records. And there's the Babylonian Chronicles, and you can go back and you can check the history of their kings and all of that. And there's Nebuchadnezzar in their histories. You can read their chronicles. You can see what they say. Those chronicles, by the way, make no mention of Nebuchadnezzar's episode that's recorded here in Daniel 4. But that's probably for self-serving reasons. The powers that be had a lot more control over history as it was written back then. As a matter of fact, if you read in Exodus, the first part of Exodus, when they're talking about the children of Israel there and the Exodus and all that sort of good stuff, you'll read about Ramses, the city of Ramses and all that. That's most likely called Ramses because Ramses was after the Pharaoh of the Exodus. But it was very common for these rulers, when they came to be kings, to rename things. Even to rename things that were made in previous kings' reign. You know, just take credit for it. Have it all point to them. So that was a very common thing. They would also leave out very embarrassing chapters in their in the history of their reign. So it's not surprising that if you go back into the Babylonian Chronicles to try to find this in Nebuchadnezzar's reign, you don't find it. But what you can do is this. Look at verse 4 in chapter 4. I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at ease in my house and prospering in my palace. And what does that tell you about this time in Nebuchadnezzar's reign? Just that little verse. What can that tell you about time period in his, what time period it might be in his reign? Or at least, I'm not asking for dates here. I'm asking what was characterizing this time in his reign. It was a good time. He was at ease. Things were prospering and all of that. And so you can go back into those Babylonian records and you can read them and you can search them, see if you can find a period of time that was characterized by that. Just to let you know, I didn't do that. I don't read Babylonian. but other students in the Bible that do read those languages have. And probably there's a 4 or 5 year period in Nebuchadnezzar's life, in his reign, as recorded in those Babylonian chronicles, where this would really fit the description. Before and after that, he was engaged in wars and putting down rebellions and all that. That's just what happens when you rule the whole world. You know, there's always fires to put out. But there's this 4 or 5 year period of time in Nebuchadnezzar's life that's not recorded. And there's almost nothing recorded of Nebuchadnezzar during that period of time. And it's also a period of time between wars and rebellions and that sort of thing. So Bible students think that that time period is probably when this happened. Okay? Now, why am I going to all this trouble to explain that? Because if that's the period of time that it happened, that means Daniel and his friends were in their late 40s. So we have quite a time jump from chapter 3 to chapter 4, and then another big, huge time jump from chapter 4 to the rest of the book of Daniel. So those first three chapters, Daniel and his three friends, Hananiah, Mishael and Azariah, they were all, those in those three chapters, they grew from 15 years to about 20 years of age. Then all of a sudden we have this story where they're they're not mentioned, but Daniel is, but he's probably in his late 40s. And then starting in chapter 5, Daniel's in his early 80s. So it's amazing to think about that. That's 60 years of time, right? And chapter 4 is the only event recorded in the book of Daniel during those 60 years. You read through the book of Daniel and you think, man, this is like them going off to Babylon is like the Pevensey kids going off to Narnia and engaged in all of these adventures, and just things are happening right and left and all of that. But really, if you think about that, the book of Daniel covers over 70 years, and there are 10 events, 10 or 11 events listed in the book of Daniel out of more than 70 years. So we can kind of fool ourselves reading through the book of Daniel, thinking it's this action-packed book that things are just happening right and left. Not really. Things were fairly dramatic at the beginning of the book, the first three chapters, those first 5 years of captivity. And then from a revelation point of view, from the point of view of God giving Daniel visions that we read in chapters 7 through 12, that was all when Daniel was in his 80s. So that part, you know, seems like a lot was happening in his private life with God. God revealing these things to him and all that. Then you have these 60 plus years in between where one event is recorded. But what an event, huh? As a matter of fact, chapters 4 and chapter 5 are the very center of the book of Daniel. The way that it's structured, this and so what it emphasized, what Daniel's emphasizing here in this chapter and the next is the very, like James pointed out, the very last sentence in chapter 4. I'll just read the whole verse. "Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, for all his works are right and his ways are just." And here's the statement: "And those who walk in pride, he is able to humble." That's what this chapter is about. Now, we're going through a workbook here. I've got an extra workbook if you guys want to share one. I know you won't have anything written down, but at least you'll be able to read read the words. Let's see. We are on page 35, 36. We're actually on page 36, the beginning of the questions. Now, you remember last week, we finished chapter 3, and I gave you two questions on chapter 4 that the author in this workbook doesn't ask, but I asked, and I'm the teacher. I get to do, isn't that right, Joe? I get to do that sort of thing, right? By the way, before I go on to that, one thing I want to point out is, just for an encouragement for you and I, Daniel's in the middle of his life, and this is one event out of 60 years it's recorded. That seems pretty uneventful. So it's an encouragement to you and I. You don't have to have an action thriller life and conquer the world in order to be useful to God. We don't know what else Daniel did in those 60 years, but only one thing was recorded. And probably Daniel was not having a midlife crisis. We in this country, since we're so focused on ourselves, we tend to have those. I just want you to, I wanted you to consider that, that this is one event in 60 years, in the middle of a 60-year period that Daniel shared. And everything else in the book of Daniel was either at the very beginning of his time in Babylon or at the very end. One event and the rest of it. So don't be discouraged that your life isn't full of things like what we read in chapters 1 through 3. Okay? Every one of us are useful to the king. Why? Well, because he saved us for that purpose, to bring glory to himself. Remember Ephesians 2, 8, and 9? You were saved by faith through grace. And then verse 10, unto good works. And then 2 Timothy 3, 16 and 17, all scripture is God-breathed and it's profitable. And the end of that, verse 17, says it's profitable to equip you for every good work. God saved you for himself. He prepared a whole road of good works for you to walk down. And he gave us his word to prepare us for those good works. And his spirit he put in us to enable us to obey him. So, just remember that about Daniel and what God has done in your life. So we're every one of us useful to God. God has things for us to do. So anyway, now those two questions that I gave you. The first one was, in the book of Daniel, this is the only chapter 4, where the narrative, the story, is told by someone other than Daniel. And when I say somebody telling the story, I'm saying when it says, I did this, and that person that's identified as the I is telling the story in the chapter, right? Every other place in the book of Daniel, it's Daniel that's doing that. Not here. It's Nebuchadnezzar. And now, you'll see that in the book of Ezra and the book of Nehemiah, where the person telling the story shifts and all of that. So it's not an uncommon thing, but it's kind of stands out in the book of Daniel because it's the only chapter that does it. Every commentary you read on this will point that out. So it stands out in the book of Daniel, but almost no one talks about why Daniel did that. Why did he let Nebuchadnezzar tell the story in chapter 4 when Daniel told the stories in all the other chapters? Why? And so I deflected that question to you guys. I asked you, what do you think? And I tried to encourage you by saying, there's no wrong or right answer here. Nobody else stands up and says why he did that. But I'm curious. What did you guys come up with? Why do you think Daniel let Nebuchadnezzar tell the story in this chapter? It's very perceptive of you. Why don't you tell them what the other's question was?
The other question was, what is Nebuchadnezzar saying?
Right, in this chapter, yeah.
But
Cat's out of the bag here. Yeah, so what you're saying is, if you answer the other question first, did Nebuchadnezzar get saved? And if you say, yes, he did, then you go back to that question and says, I'm pretty sure that's why Daniel let Nebuchadnezzar tell this story, because it's the story of his salvation. So that's very good. Woo! You get 5 stars. Anybody else have any other thoughts? Yes.
And at the end of the chapter, or through the teeth of the chapter, it's the bottom of the bottom. So you get the power of both of those extremes.
Yes.
From the king's mouth.
Yeah. Exactly. This isn't some speechwriter off in some room writing some good PR thing for Nebuchadnezzar to but it's from the horse's mouth, the cow's mouth. That's just a little joke about what's in the chapter. Straight from the horse's mouth here. And yeah, no, that's good.
Couldn't it be also that Nebuchadnezzar, because I mean, the way it starts off, the very beginning of the chapter, Nebuchadnezzar the king, to all the people, nations, and men of every language that lived in all the earth, your peace of mouth, like he's writing.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Right. Yeah, so what you're saying, if I'm hearing you right, what you're saying is what he is saying is something that God once proclaimed throughout the world, and so he's letting the emperor proclaim it to his empire.
So he does that, then Daniel goes, yep, thank you.
That's right, exactly. Exactly. Yes. Well, what about 36 and 37?
What got me about 35 was just knowing this Babylonian kingdom and how powerful they were, and Nebuchadnezzar, and he was, and the fact that he can say everything he said in 35.
Yes.
Being the man that he was.
Yes.
You know, it's kind of like to show that his dominion lasts. His will.
Yes.
And the inhabitants of the earth are counted as nothing compared to him.
Yes.
He can't.
Right. Right. Exactly.
No matter how powerful.
Exactly. Who can stay his hand?
Yeah.
Yeah. And notice the progression in chapters 2, 3, and 4. In chapter 2, what did Nebuchadnezzar learn about Daniel and his God? About Daniel's God. Yes, he's the revealer of secrets, of mysteries. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar was absolutely floored that Daniel not only could interpret his dreams, he's used to magicians and Chaldeans interpreting dreams, but Daniel could tell him exactly what he dreamed. Oh, you mean he wasn't so overwhelmed in chapter 4 as he was in chapter 2? Yeah. Yeah. He had already learned that. That's why he called Daniel, wasn't it, in chapter 4? He had already learned it back in chapter 2. Yeah, so he knew that. He learned that. Sixty.
Who is operating in a very high position within the kingdom, doing his job,
Oh, yeah, an action thriller life. Yes, yes. So, chapter 2, he learned that God is Daniel's God, the God of the Israelites, is a God who knows secrets, mysteries. He's the one that can reveal anything. But it didn't lead to his conversion, did it? What did he learn in chapter 3? Pardon? Yes. He's the no God can save the way that Daniel's God can save, that the Israelites' God can save. Remember, when they came out of the furnace, they didn't even smell like smoke. I mean, there was no singed hair on them. They didn't even smell like smoke. And as James told us, that he could take 4 or 5 showers after a fire, and he'd come home and his wife would tell him, "You stink like smoke." That you can't get that smell off of you. Those three guys, they didn't even have the smell of smoke on them. So the extent and the detail of God's deliverance of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego was amazing. So he learned in chapter 2 just how God has, Daniel's God has all secrets, all mysteries, everything. He's a revealer of those. Chapter 3, it took it to another level. Not only that, but he is so powerful. His delivering power is absolutely incredible. It was unheard of that somebody could have lived through that. Remember, they made the furnace big enough back in those days. They made those furnaces big enough so the kings and those close around him could watch the person burn. And remember, Nebuchadnezzar gasped and stumbled down the stairs saying, "There's a fourth person in there." And they saw all four of them in there walking around. And he calls the three out, and they didn't even smell like smoke. So he says, "There is no God who can deliver the way Daniel, the Israelite God, can." But it still didn't lead to his conversion. Because, you know, by this time, the Israelite God was catapulting up the power rankings, right? I mean, they were headed up near the top of the power rankings. Those of you that follow football and basketball, you know what I'm talking about, power rankings. But anyway, so Nebuchadnezzar was incredibly impressed with the God of Israel, but he hadn't made him his personal God. He hadn't seen that the other gods were no gods. What did he have to learn? What's the lesson he learns in chapter 4? That the God of Israel is a God that rules him. He rules every king. And he can make the lowliest of men king. And he learns that in a very real way, doesn't he? In a very literal way. He can take a cow out of the field and make him king, is what he learns in chapter 4. You can see this progression in Nebuchadnezzar's life. Brian.
Yeah, no, I was just verse 17.
Of 4?
Yeah, where he says, the living, like toward the end, the living may know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men.
Yes.
And gives it to whom he will, and sets over it to the lowest of men.
Yeah, exactly.
What other God says whatever, it doesn't
Exactly, because they believed they were made king by their gods. Right. So here's another way of looking at the progression. Is Nebuchadnezzar's God does so much. I mean, Israel's God does so much. Israel's God does everything. He reveals secrets. He delivers like no other God can. And he alone is the one that rules men and sets up kings and all of that. And so here's another way of looking at the answer. There's nothing left for any other God to do. So there must not be any other God, because Israel's God does everything and there's nothing left for any other deity to do. So you can see that progression in Nebuchadnezzar's life. It's kind of really great to follow that, to see that. But notice this third and final lesson that he learns comes, you know, probably 25 years or so after. Let's see, 20 to maybe 27, 28 years, between 25 and 30 years after the lessons that he learned in chapters 2 and 3. So, he was a tough nut to crack. But when you think about it, this is what we have to think about when we share the gospel, when we tell people about the good news. We're not the ones delivering them from the domain of darkness. We're the heralds. We're just proclaiming the good news. It's the Spirit's work, okay? And no matter how hard a person has made their heart, it's no match for the omnipotent work of the Spirit. So, like one man said, our job is not to bring the world to Christ, but to bring Christ to the world. And that is exactly what Daniel and his friends did. They brought the God of Israel to Babylon with them. And it became, we see in the first three chapters, right away, it was public info in the empire. Those four were raised to the highest positions in the worldwide empire. And it remained that way for 60 years or so. And yet, it was God himself, the Holy Spirit, that did this to Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 4 and brought him to see to saving faith in Yahweh. Now, let me just say this. You know, Bible students, they debate whether or not Nebuchadnezzar got saved. You read the first three verses of chapter 4. You read the last three or four or five verses of chapter 4. And you think, what is there to debate? It just sounds, it's so much different than his responses in chapters 2 and chapter 3. Yes, he was floored. I mean, in chapter 3, remember, he fell on his face in front of Daniel. I mean, in front of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He was so overwhelmed by the deliverance that their God had performed. But you read these verses at the beginning and the end of chapter 4, they're just totally different. But here is a key verse in the whole debate. Look, it's 8 and 9, verses 8 and 9. I think I told you this last week, that this is a key verse in the whole discussion. Nebuchadnezzar said, "At last, Daniel came in before me. He who is named Belteshazzar, after the name of my God, and in whom is the spirit of the holy gods." And I told him the dream, saying, "O Belteshazzar, chief of the magicians, because I know that the spirit of the holy gods is in you, and that no mystery is too difficult for you, tell me the vision of my dream that I saw and their interpretation." Notice in verse 8, he says, "At last Daniel came in before me, he who is named Belteshazzar, after the name of my God." Okay? Now, remember, this is written. Nebuchadnezzar wrote this after the events of this chapter. So the perspective of him writing this is after those closing verses. So commentators will point to verse 8 and said, see, he sees that the God of Israel he's at the top of the power rankings. But he hasn't made the God of Israel his own personal God. And that's the way verse 8 can seem to read. But there's another, and then they also point out, before I get on to my responses to those, he says, in whom, at the end of verse 8, and in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. And they all point to gods being plural there. And they point to that, says that's a polytheistic statement. So they'll say, see, even after the events of chapter 4, he's saying that Bel or Marduk is his personal God, and he describes Daniel from a polytheistic point of view. The spirit of the holy gods, plural, is in him. Sure, I can do that. Yes, I'm the teacher and I'm in control. Go ahead. Yeah, and that's the way that I respond to that. That's what I would do. I would say, just think of it. If you're telling a story, it's not unusual to put yourselves back in your shoes during the story. And so that would have been his perspective. Now, we don't know that for sure, but because he doesn't say at the end of chapter 4, now Yahweh is my personal God. I mean, he doesn't come out and say it explicitly like that to settle all of the debate, right? But that's my response, is to say he's recounting it from his perspective back then.
So he's like giving his testimony?
Yeah. Pretty cool, isn't it? The hairy chest bully of the world is up there giving his testimony.
What I thought was pretty vivid as well was how he said, here's my reasoning beforehand, and now here's when my reason returns to me. You've got a completely different set of how he even reasons as the man.
Right.
His mind was just stripped from it completely.
Right. Right. Yeah. And the other thing to point out is he was named after my God, and in whom is the spirit of the holy gods, the plural there for gods. That's used more than once in the Old Testament. Sometimes it's translated singular. Sometimes it's translated plural. So the form of it in the Hebrew here, it could be either a polytheistic statement or a monotheistic statement. So just the fact that it was translated plural in the English here in this particular context does not necessarily mean that that's what it really is. Now, if he's stating everything perfectly from his point of view prior to getting saved, then maybe he meant to make this a polytheistic statement here, because he was a polytheist back before, you know. His timeline was polytheistic, cow, monotheist. That's what we read in the chapter here. Yes. Say that again. Yes. And that's another point. He didn't immediately go to seminary and have a good Bible education when he wrote out this letter. You know, I'm sure. But here's the thing. When you read through everything he says here, there is a lot of biblical thought in there. So his whole perspective was changed. That's the way I read it. There's a lot of biblical thought there, even if he wasn't well taught at that point in time. There's a lot of biblical thought laced throughout what he does say. So it's clearly a change in the way that we see him thinking in chapters 1, 2, and 3. So yes, I think to me the bulk of the evidence overwhelmingly points in the direction that he got saved. And yes, I agree with Nick. Even though Daniel doesn't tell us why he lets Nebuchadnezzar tell the story, I think he's letting Nebuchadnezzar tell his testimony is the way that I read that. And that's pretty cool. You know? Just think. You got 60 more years. You might lead an emperor to the Lord. You know, that's the story of Daniel 4. So, next, we go through the author's questions, but it's, I think, 3 minutes till the end of the class. So, you guys are in good form. So we probably wouldn't get very far in trying to answer the very first question. So we'll just start up next week right there. It'll make up for all the times that I went over. Okay. So any other comments or questions about what we've talked about so far with Daniel 4? Yes, yes, and he does right. No belly aching, nothing like that. Yes, exactly. Yes, personalized it, and said, it was right, it was good, and I praise and extol his name. That's pretty cool. That, right. James says, he's just protecting himself because he may turn me into a cow again. Okay. Well, Seth, why don't you close us in prayer?